tell me when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in Kilburn in London in 1924.
And could you tell us a bit about your family and the sort of life you led as a young child?
Well, I was conceived in Carlo, actually, and my parents booked the hotel, not the hotel, the hospital where I was to be born, but they decided 3 months before I was due that it might be better if I was born where there was perhaps some decent medical and a hospital to go to if necessary. So we moved back. Incidentally, my mother was born in Corfu because my grandfather, her father, was a civil engineer, and he was sent out to Corfu to drain the marsh to get rid of the mosquito, malaria mosquito, at the turn of the century. And while he was there, my mother was born, and also her sister, the two girls, the older one, Mabel, and my mother's name was Nora Simmons. And after he'd worked there, they were both born in Corfu, and then he got another job in Greece, and lived in what's the name of the harbour?
Piraeus.
That's right, just outside Athens. And they were there for some time, and then they moved to Egypt, where he had a job. He was asked to survey the land from Cairo right down to Luxor, I think about 500 miles, see if it was suitable to put a railway down there. And incidentally, I went down on a holiday some years ago, not many years ago, 10 or 12 years, no, perhaps longer, 15 years ago, and went down the Nile on a boat, and I could see a little engine train going down by the side of us, and I thought, yes, my grandfather has surveyed all that land for the Egyptian railway. So that was interesting. He died in the year I was born, in 1904, actually, so I never knew him. During the war, my mother and her sister, Mabel, were sent during the war to London. Well, it was before the war, actually, before 1914, when they were 14 years old. My mother was born in 1904, so it would be 1910. They were sent to boarding school, Channing House School near Highgate, and the war broke out, and of course they couldn't get back home to Egypt. So they used to stay during the holidays with friends in Sussex on a farm. And then after the war, they went back. And my mother got a job in the British consulate there, I think it was, as a typist. And they settled down there. And they lived in a place called Heliopolis, just outside Cairo. And that's where she met my father, who was also working for the Egyptian government. He was a printer, and he was a lot older than her. They met at a tennis club in Heliopolis, and he swept her off her feet, rather. And he'd been married before, but was divorced because he was in the First World War and came home and found his wife sleeping with a butcher, I think it was. And so that was the end of that. Anyway, her parents, my grandparents, didn't agree to the marriage, so she ran off and they got married at All Saints Church in Cairo. And it's been demolished now, it doesn't exist anymore. So I was born. Oh, my father had a gratuity from the Egyptian government. It was quite a lot of money in those days. I think it was about £28,000, which was incredible. It really was a lot of money. And so when we came home, or they came home, before I was born, they had bought a house in Christchurch Avenue in Kilburn, London. And hired a nanny for the birth. And I appeared on the 11th of August, as I said, in 1924. My father didn't know what to do with himself. He had all this money, and he opened a photographer's shop in Camden Town. And that's why I've got so many photographs of myself as a baby and so on. And as he got bored with that, he chucked it up and said he's going on the stage. And he went to acrobatic dancing. He had a partner. And while he was away, incidentally, my mother knew nobody in England because she'd been brought up in Egypt. She was at boarding school during the war. And he used to go out on tours. And one day he said that he's going off on a tour to Manchester for a week. and every back at the end of the week. In actual fact, 3 weeks later, she got a letter from South Africa saying, "I'm in Johannesburg and I'm not coming back. Give my love to Ralphie." And that was the last we saw of him. I found him years later, which was in the 50s. I was 3 years old when he went, incidentally. And during that time, the Depression was in full swing, of course. And my mother didn't know a soul in England. She'd never worked because they had servants in Cairo. In fact, they had a big Sudanese manservant. And they had a little kitten, as she tells the story. And she used to say, "Puss, puss, puss," when she was giving it its food. And she said, "Now you must learn to say puss, puss." And he has great big Sudanese lips. And he used to say, "Boozy, boozy, boozy," and frighten the poor kitten away. But that's just by the way. She didn't know, she was left on her own, no unemployment benefit for women, height of the Depression. She was rather a beautiful woman. She met someone, I don't know who it was, he was an artist, and he had a portrait of her. He painted a portrait of her, which was hung in the National Portrait Gallery, except there. I wish I could get hold of it. That's my mother over there, incidentally. So she was desperate. We lived in Camden Town, back at the glue works, which was bombed during the war. I think I had a slight touch of Ricky's, but I'm not sure about that, because she wasn't very good at cooking, to say the least, she never was. And she was desperate to earn money. There was no unemployment benefit for women in those days. And so she went canvassing vacuum cleaners from door to door and commission only, when people didn't have enough to buy bread, let alone vacuum cleaners. So that wasn't very successful.
It was a tough time.
Yeah, it was tough in those days. I didn't know anything about that. I mean, I accepted it, as you do as a child. And she told me the story. They had a gas stove, and in the old-fashioned gas stoves, underneath the oven, it was open. It wasn't closed. And she bought a six-penny sheep's head one day to make soup out of. And before she was going to make the soup, she put it in a dish and put it into the gas stove oven. When she went to get it, because there was no fridge in those days, she opened the door and found a rat sitting on its head, on her head. So that had to go in the dustbin. And another time, she moved away and managed to get some rooms in near Jack Straw's castle up on Hampstead Heath. And we shared a bed together, apparently. I don't remember this at all. And she had the sash window open onto the pavement. And one night she felt a hand coming through the window and shaking her. And she woke up with a start, and it was a policeman. And he said, "I shouldn't advise you to sleep with your window open on the pavement like this for people passing by." But anyway, nothing's happened, so that was all right. she was really desperate for money and didn't know quite what to do. So in the meantime, as I said, my grandfather had died in 1924. And my grandmother had moved back to England and got a house. And so we went to live with her. That was in Sutton Road, I think it was.
South Down Road?
South Down Road, that's right. South Down Road in... I can't remember.
Muswell Hill,
that's right. Yes, you've better heard my story than I am.
No, I've just got your notes here.
So we stayed there, but my mother and her mother, my grandmother, didn't get on at all well. So that was that. And then she wondered what to do, because my grandmother was keeping us, and she met someone in films. A chap called Terence Greenidge, who had been up at Oxford in his younger days, and he kept pestering her to marry him, but she said, "No, I don't want to marry you." And he said, "Well, at least I can give you a reasonable home." So she said, "Well, I'll marry you on one condition, and that is I need to have my son educated," which was me, of course. And had my son educated, and I need a place to live. Well, there wasn't a very good basis for a marriage. And he was a writer. He wrote several books, one called Degenerate Oxford, and he's very keen on filmmaking. I've got a lot of films, 16mm film, of the students, or the undergraduates rather, at the Oxford, who made these amateur films. And the BBC have had them and put them together and re-spliced them and one thing or another. They're quite interesting because Norman Angel was a great friend of his in a lot of the films, and Elsa Lanchester, who is she married to now? Elsa Lanchester, the chap who played the Hunchback in Notre Dame.
Charles Laughton.
Charles Laughton, she was married to Charles Laughton. And the film I've got is of the very first time she was in any type of film. So these are quite interesting. And the National Film Archives have been on to me just recently, as we speak now, in 2003. I can't get used to 2003 somehow. You get so used to saying 19 this and 19 that, but 2003 sounds very odd. However, be that as it may, what happened then? So they got married.
That would be in 1930.
Yes, that was 1930, and I was at the wedding. In fact, I'm very lucky. I've got them. All her their film friends used tripods as an arch from the registry office, and I've got a movie of that 16mm of myself as 8 years old. So that's 61 years ago. Is it? No, it's more than that. How old am I? 79. Gosh, I'm in my 80th year. Can't believe where it's all gone to.
So where did you stay in Muswell Hill, or did you move there?
No, we moved there, and then we moved to Mill Hill. Rudyard Groves, at the bottom of Deansgate, I remember it well. And I was sent to, how old was I then? I was about, what's getting on now? 1926? Born in 24, no, a bit older than that. Because I was sent to a convent school, St. Rose's Convent, at Mill Hill, which took little boys up to the age of 7, I think, or up to the age of 11, I'm not quite sure which. But I remember we used to have to sing Rule Britannia, Stand at Attention, while the nuns were pretty strict. In fact, I got belted by one of them. I always remember I was told to bend over the chair, and she took her belt off and started giving me a leveling. And I remember thinking how her skirt billowed out like a ship in full sail as she whacked me. I think it was because she caught me looking at the little girl's knickers or something. Quite possibly. I wanted elastic for catapult, I expect.
Was it a good school? Or?
No, it was horrible. I hated it. And then I went to 7 schools altogether. We lived in Mill Hill for that. Now, that marriage was not a success at all. Incidentally, it was rather interesting. My stepfather, who was a Terence, his name is Terence Greenidge, incidentally, he's spelled Greenidge, and not the other way. They came from Barbados originally, where there were lots of Greenidges, because my grandfather, his father was a sugar planter. His grandpa, I'm not sure which, and he had a small legacy from there. Then what happened? Well, that suddenly there appeared another man on the doorstep. There was always men about my mother because she was a very good-looking woman, and she attracted the men in a certain way. And one she fell for was a chap I got a portrait of up there. His name was Reg Reynolds. My mother painted that portrait, and he was the founder of the No More War movement. Plans to get pacifist before the war. They all know me. He used to have a badge with two hands breaking a rifle. And my mother was a pacifist as well. And she fell for this chap, but he was already married to a novelist called Naomi Mitchison. And he was quite a well-known author at the time, and still is, I suppose. And then someone else came along, and this chap was called Langdon Davies. Bernard Noel Langdon Davies, and he was a publisher. He'd been up at Cambridge, incidentally, and was president of a union up there, and did a lot of cramming afterwards. He had first class honours degree in the classics, which didn't help him much getting a job during the hard times. No one wanted a classics degree, particularly. And he came along. He was already married, but he hadn't lived with his wife for many, many years. He was a lot older than my mother, 20 years older. And he said, "I'm going to Corsica. Do you want to come and bring the two kids as well?" And she said, "Not half," or words to that effect. And that was interesting because he had a friend called Major Blake, who was in the Royal Flying Corps in the First World War and amazingly survived it. And he was quite a rich man and went out gold prospecting in New Guinea, couldn't settle down after the war at all. And another one of his ventures was buying an old castle, old French castle in Corsica, and running it as a hotel. And he said, he died, and his wife said, his name was Blake, incidentally, they called him the Mad Major, Major Blake. He suddenly died, and his wife was left with all these bits and pieces, and she said to Langdon, we called him affectionately, his name's Langdon, she said, "I've got this place, and if I don't inhabit it for 5 years, it reverts to the mayor of the village. Would you like it on a permanent loan?" So he said, "Yeah, why not?" He did some writing. He was a bit of an author as well, and he'd been. He's a very interesting background, which I'll come to in a minute. But he said yes, why not? So he didn't have any money. He never had any money. Although he'd been trained as a barrister, but was never called to the bar. And he was a conscientious objector during the First World War, and went in front of the tribunal and was given the job of working in a bakery. And he used to work in a bakery at night and work for a publisher called Williams and Norgate during the day. He was publishing. And anyway, all this went by the board when he heard about this Corsican business. He was always doing good things. He organized during the war, at the end of the war, 1918. Apparently the Germans had a lot of milk, tin milk, to give to their babies because most people were starving at that time. But the babies couldn't drink the milk, and he organised the sending of thousands of rubber teats for bottles to Germany for babies so that they could have this condensed milk, I suppose it would be. That was quite interesting. And anyway, what he did was he thought, I'm surmising now, how he's going to get money to go to Corsica. Because in those days, you didn't go on a plane and got there in an hour and a half. You had to get a train down and catch the boat train and down to wherever, I forget where we were from, and across the channel, right across France. And by that time, I had a little sister, I forgot to tell you that, who was 7 years younger than me, was the product of Terence Greenwich and my mother. So she was my half sister, really. And she carried the most useful thing for a child, travelling by train without corridors in those days, or if they did have corridors even, I think this is actually, was carrying a potty. And my sister, who was about two, I think, had a little knapsack with a pot in it, and that was the most useful thing. That was a brilliant thing to have taken that. Anyway.
And what had happened to Greenwich?
Well, he lived in the world and was. He was an academic and lived in a world of his own. He wasn't very sorry if you're going to Corsica, well, enjoy yourself, and carried on messing about with it. He just had enough money to keep himself from this legacy, so he didn't have to work. But he was an actor as well, I forgot to mention that. He did a lot of acting, and he had a great friend called Rudolf Massel, who owned Lundy Island, which pops up from time to time, having been sold by the other person, and they made a film on Lundy, a pirate film, which I've got, some the old 16mm films that they used to use. And
so he just sort of faded out of the story?
He faded out, yeah. So they always get into always great friends. I mean, when we came back years later, all the husbands used to come from Sunday afternoon for tea and so on, you know, very civilised. And going back to Langdon, what he did, he knew a lot of people, and he organised a cocktail party in Charing Cross Road, that they upstairs where they have these lunches, literary lunches and so on. And he hired the room and invited all his friends. A lot of them were quite well known and quite rich. And he said, the invitation was to say farewell to our trip, this adventure going to Corsica. It was a great adventure in those days. And he said, and then as Eccles got a drink, he said, "Well, I'm afraid I haven't got any money to go, but I'm going to kind of pass around the hat, and if you'd be kind enough to lend me a fiver, it would be most useful." And he went round and everyone put a fiver or whatever, a fiver or a tenner, and he had enough to for us to go, well, four of us to go to Corsica, start this hotel, and take staff over with us as well. It was amazing. And years later, I found a list of all the people who lent him money and how much they'd lent him, and and he ticked it when he paid it off, which they didn't mean, most of them, they didn't ask for it back. I think they were all pretty well off. And so he raised enough money, to cheek of the devil. And so off we went to Corsica. When we got there, we found that, unfortunately, the roof leaked badly. Now, I might add, this is in 1930. My daughter, my sister,
32?
1932, something like that, yes. People weren't having holidays in 1932. There were no package holidays or flying for a couple of hours to get to Rome or something. You slogged it the hard way. And it took a long time to get to Corsica. It took even longer coming back because I had no money. We were broke. Nobody came out to Corsica on a holiday in the middle 30s or thereabouts. And there was even talk of war. Hitler was stamping his feet and one thing and another and hiring it. In those days, and we had about three people in 2 years who came out.
The hotel,
it was called the Castle Inn, Algaiola, near Calvi. And I've been back several times. Oh, I went to school there, in actual fact.
What was it like? You were about eight then?
Yes, eight.
What did you think when you got out there?
Well, I loved it. I was the only one that was fit. Poor old Langdon had a poison foot very badly, trod on something. My mother, who'd caught malaria in Egypt, had bouts of it, as you would do, going to back to a warmer climate. And my sister was always a bit of a weakling. And I was the only one. I went to school there. I went barefooted there, like all the other kids. I rather liked Dull. Did you see that series on the television of Dull, who lived in Corfu? It's the same life that I had. It was amazing. I mean, I used to go with all... The first word I learned when I went to school there, and the village school was the village hall. Everything happened there. The first word I went was a Corsican word called Capisce Mica, which is very similar to Italian, which for I don't understand. Il Capisce, I think, in Italian. And because, I mean, they'd never seen anyone from England before, these little village children. Nor had the adults come to that. And, I can tell you an awful lot about Corsica. We're going back over the years. And so they used to crowd around me and all shouting and screaming and one thing or another. And I went to the school there. And years later, 30, 40 years later, I went back. And the same schoolmistress was there in the village. And she saw me and said, "Ah, Monsieur Raff, comment ça va? Ça va bien, n'est-ce pas?" And she put her arms around me, and then she took me into the classroom. There was only one classroom for all the children in the village. It wasn't a very big village. And she said, "Here." And she gave me a pot with a broken spout. And she said, "Every year since you went away, 30 years ago, my class has drawn this as still life." And I've got the vase. And she said, "You gave it to me as a parting present." As a child, I don't remember that. I said, by the way. So it wasn't very successful. But the amazing coincidences were happening. Years later, I wanted to go to back to Corsica for the first time. Well, I was living in Scotland then, and I booked up, I forget the name of the firm, to go to Corsica. About a fortnight before we were due to go on this package tour, they wrote to me and said that they were unable to get enough people to go and would have to cancel it. But they offered me another one, which was a Lazio. This was 1962, a Lazio in Italy. So I said, "Oh, I would take that." And then a couple of years later, I booked it again with a firm, and this time we went. they got there. And we stayed in the village. They'd actually built a couple of new hotels in the village, which were way back from the beach, and it hadn't spoiled the... It wasn't a belly dorm or anything like that. And we were having dinner on a terrace, and a little Jewish couple was sitting next to us. Leant over and said to me, are you enjoying your holiday? And I said, yes, very much. He said, have you been before? And I said, yes. As a matter of fact, he said, oh, really? He said, we've been before as well. We're back in the 30s. We had some friends. We came and stayed here. But they had a little boy who used to run around barefoot, I remember. And I said, yes, you're speaking to him. That was an amazing coincidence because we changed the year, we changed the date and so on. Anyway, to get back to the 30s, I don't know if we got where we did get
so
to.
What was life like for you?
As a child living in Corsica in the 30s, it was fun. I mean, I got to learn to speak French, of course, because it's a French possession. French was taught in the school, and they spoke Corsican outside of school, so I learned both. And I've forgotten both. You forget very quickly when you're a child, if you don't keep it up. We used to say, when we came back from Corsica, we'd have one day a week, which being nothing but French. But after about 6 months, that went by the board, I'm afraid. We had a lot of fun. For instance, we used to go, when there was a day off from school, we used to go on the rocks with get an old dinner fork and tie it onto a stick and go looking for crabs in the crevices and digging them out and get limpets off the rocks and catch a few fish. Not very good. Mediterranean fish is all a bit bony. Not very good. And then at the end of the day, we put it all in a pot on the and we sit on it, and we got driftwood, and we made a fire, and we made bouillabaisse, fish soup, in other words, and it was delicious. We used to tip it out onto a flat rock, and we used to have a stick which we sharpened into a point and dug into this stew, and it was great, man. It was great, great fun. That's where I learned to swim. And
there was some trouble with the local villagers about your maid.
Oh, yes. Well, what happened was that Langdon had taken some staff out with him. My mother was a housekeeper. He took, I can't remember the proper names and the nicknames, Gigi, who was an Irish girl with a young boy, younger than me. She was a cook. Then there was Tessa. And she was interesting. She was a maid. She came from a well-educated family. Her name was Tessa O'Sullivan. And she was always in trouble with flirting with the boys. And you don't flirt with Corsicans in the 30s. They pull a gun on you if you're not careful.